pleased to welcome all of our listeners back to View from the Roundhouse with Professor Martin Drum. Good morning, Martin.
Fantastic to join you as always, Michael.
Well, we'll eventually get to it, but let me just ask you at the outset, do you have a red bin at your home, Martin?
I do. And I've got also a yellow one and a green one. So I've got the four traffic lights, I think.
Our listeners will know exactly what we're talking about, and we are going to get there at the end because politics can at times be a very strange thing. But let's just go back to where we've been a few times, Martin. The whole gambling issue in Australia, it's been fought by some very sturdy campaigners over decades. It looks like something's going to happen. Whether or not everyone's going to be happy with it is another thing. What's your take on where we're at and how we got here?
Well, I think there's a few things there. This has been raised as an issue for some time. Several things are true in this space. Australia does have a gambling addiction problem. We are one of the worst gamblers by volume in OECD countries. We know this. There's a lot of data that supports that. A lot of Australians love a flutter, so it's part of, you can argue there's a cultural piece, but underneath that is a problem gamblers piece where people are unable to control this as an addiction, and then it permeates through so many other areas. So where's this take us in terms of politics and the current political debate? The current political debate is focused around taking some action around gambling advertising and perhaps the inducements that companies offer people who are gambling. There was a parliamentary report on this by the now deceased Peter Murphy that was quite scathing about the gambling industry and how they targeted people, calling for really stringent action, decisive action on this. And then there was recently a parliamentary inquiry where we heard from gamblers about the awful things that were going on, given drugs, sex workers, all these sorts of things to induce them to gambling. So there's a moral imperative I think politicians are facing around doing something. But, Michael, there's some vested interests involved. There's elite sports organisations and major media companies that benefit a lot from the gambling advertising. So do our politicians really want to take them on?
The answer seems to be no, but the crossbench, particularly up in the Senate, are anxious, it seems, to get results. But, of course, in our parliamentary system at the moment, all you need to do is get the Labor Party, who's in government, and the Liberal National Coalition to agree on something and they can ram it through both houses of Parliament, Martin. Is that what's happening?
So there was a proposal to limit gambling advertising to set numbers of ads per hour, which is kind of doing a little bit, but not fully addressing the problem. I think most people who look at that would say. And the opposition were actually asked after them to go a bit further and address the inducements problem in particular. The Greens and some of the crossbench would like them to go much further and actually ban it. So I think that they're seeing a good deal with the opposition as the main pathway forward. And so they're doing some work around inducements, Michael, to get this over the line.
Well, it'll probably happen when? This coming week?
I would expect it to happen this coming week. I think the government's keen to have some wins on the board. And even the opposition might claim it's a bit of a moral victory for them because they've raised the issue around inducements and got the government to act.
Changing the topic, Martin, around election time and often times in between each of the major political parties and even the smaller ones all try to appeal to a particular part of the electorate. You mentioned the Greens, they sort of offer themselves as environmentalists and truly worried about the future of the planet, trying to get to net zero. Other parties appeal to those who are more of a capitalist way of thinking. And sometimes it's said that people with particular ethnic histories and backgrounds gravitate towards one party or another. It's once thought that all the Irish Catholics voted for the Labor Party. I'm not sure that that's true anymore. But now we've got a suggestion by Barnaby Joyce, the coalition national turncoat, who's now with One Nation, But the One Nation Party is the gayest party. Did you see that?
Indeed. And look, it's part of me was choking on my cornflakes when I was listening to that. It's quite a funny interview. But look, and this might surprise you, he may actually have a slight point here, Michael. Let's go back to the issue that's triggered this. There was a One Nation candidate in WA who had made some very outrageous and frankly, I think, pretty homophobic comments about how people who are gay had mental illness. And I mean, that shocked everyone. And that was criticised by Pauline Hanson and others who said that that didn't reflect her views. People will say plenty of things about Pauline Hanson, but her record with gays is an interesting one, Michael. Probably her closest political advisor in the party is a fellow called James Ashby. He's openly gay. And when the One Nation leader in New South Wales, Mark Latham, had a crack at a gay member of the New South Wales State Parliament, she firmly and publicly rebuked him. And that was one of the things that led to their falling out and him leading the party. So I don't know if that makes One Nation the gay party in Parliament, as Alan Royce might have opined, Michael, but her record around working with gay people is not quite as people might think it, I think. I think that she does have gay people in her party and she has rebuked people who've spoken out against it. So that's just my two cents worth, Michael. Might surprise some of your listeners.
Well, it won't surprise people who follow politics because they understand that every party is trying to get every possible vote they can possibly get. So you show that you are broad in your outlooks and it's your economic and other policies usually that you hope get you over the line. And you'd think that of the Liberal and National Coalition, particularly the Liberal Party, you'd think they'd all be sitting down together and working out what their policies are. They're having a hard time in the Liberal Party at the moment. And yet Senator Bragg's out there doing his own bragging, his own commentary at Martin. He's on about immigration, he's on about housing, he's in the National Press Club. You wouldn't want to be Angus Taylor with this guy seemingly going a little AWOL, Martin.
I think he was trying to innovate in the policy area around housing, but you've got to be very, very careful and you want to be obviously sending your ideas by a party leadership. And I think this is where he got himself into a bit of a mess here and got rebuked by his party leaders. So his essential argument is you need to get more houses out into the market. So maybe we should accept less regulation by doing so. Okay, interesting idea. But then people started asking what that actually meant. And he got himself in a slight mess because they said, well, does that mean that people who are, you know, don't have as much money, should just accept lower standard housing. And it sort of indicated that that's, well, I guess so, if you don't have the money to do. So it's one of those things where you had a way of trying to air an idea and then you get yourself bogged down and make a bit of a mess of things. It's probably not what the coalition needs right now. They've got a lot of issues facing them around relevance, around finding their own spot in the political spectrum with One Nation spectre hanging over them. And they probably all need to be on the same song sheet at the moment.
Well, Mark, it partly makes me think of the occasion when the former WA Premier Colin Barnett was being sniped at about the failure of the Electricity Commission to keep the power on all the time during the hot days and that people weren't able to run their air conditioners and so on. And in a moment of frustration, I suspect, he said, well, why can't they just do what we did when I was a kid? He's the same age as me and I sympathise with this. He said, open the windows and let the air in. But not everybody thought it was the best political comment to make. But everybody's sort of making the same comments about AUKUS at the moment. People keep saying it's here and it's here to stay and get over it. The US seem enthusiastic about it once again as well, Martin.
Well, the interesting thing was some comments by one of Donald Trump's top advisors in this area, a guy who had called for a review into AUKUS and who had previously been somewhat critical, quite critical of AUKUS. And he was firmly off the same song sheet as the president and much the Australian commentary from Australia's political leaders anyway, and saying it's full steam ahead and it's all on track. So I think for people that are supporters of AUKUS and planning for jobs and investment and other things that come with that, they'll be quite reassured by that. I don't think it will reassure critics of AUKUS, of course, Michael, is still asking questions about timelines and about costs and a range of other things.
Well, Martin, did you notice when you did the census the other night, and I'm assuming, of course, that you, like me, like all good Australians, filled the form in online, I expect, most of us. There was no question about AUKUS in it. What did you make of the census?
Yeah, I missed the question on AUKUS in the census, but I did fill it out, of course, as was our duty. Look, for many of us, filling out the census is a bit ho-hum because we've been doing so consistently from a very young age. But of course, there's always a few for whom this is somewhat of an outrage and an imposition, Michael. So I think it brings out all those conspiracy theorists who believe it's a tool for government to know every part of their intimate affairs. They do so while scrolling on their socials, Michael, scrolling through content which is very carefully curated for them based on them having shared every other detail of their lives voluntarily. So, of course, who could say, I won't be preaching to those people about the incongruence in their thinking, but nevertheless, it does create all of those debates every time we have it.
It does make you wonder whether we need a census anymore. The government's got access to just about everything we think. Well, they can go to the algorithm companies and ask them if they know what we think. And they can probably draw it all together, Martin. It didn't take me long to fill it out. And there was a very simple one there about your sexual preferences and your religions, religious directions as well. It was pretty well drafted, I thought.
What a neutral piece. I don't think that has leading questions. I think that's a part of it. You know, people get stuck on the religious question, but I think that's a question of your identity that you answer according to your own wishes there. I think that it serves two purposes still. One is that the government has been able to use this as a longitudinal tool to plan effectively for a period of time. And secondly, I work in a university, Michael, and I can tell you a lot of researchers find that census data very helpful in trying to understand where there's issues, problems, challenges, emerging trends, etc. So as a data set, it's been quite an effective one over a long period of time.
Well, we'll probably get the results, as you say, through the researchers, what, 10, 15 years, Martin, or maybe a little earlier, he says, sceptically.
Well, it takes probably 6 to 9 months for the full details to come out around census. But it's I can tell you, yeah, our researchers do use that material pretty thoroughly.
Well, they should be able to tell us when they do report whether the Fremantle Dockers won the 2026 Grand Final, Martin. We'll get there soon enough. But what they're also getting to soon enough is an election in Victoria, where the central issue seems to have become whether or not they have a weekly red bin collection. What do you think about that? Is politics completely off the rails now, Martin?
Firstly, I always thought household waste, it was firmly a local government issue. If ever there was, you know, local government rates and rubbish. So it struck me as a bit odd that it would become a state government issue. And then there's sort of age-old debate over how frequently your bins are collected. So I like having my bin collected every week, but I think it really does depend on the size of your household, et cetera. So I've got four people in my immediate household, and we probably prefer that. But you know, you've got the cost that comes with that, and also you've got there's a third issue that sort of often comes up here, and that's who knows what to put into what bin, Michael. That's been the other issue, and that's the issue that's reared its head in this area in Western Australia more recently.
Well, I think I've been studying this lately that the bin collection system, is similar. You've got the green top into which the waste and cuttings goes, all the food waste. You've got the yellow top into which all of the recycling, paper and cardboard and plastics and bottles go. Then you've got the red bin where the bottle tops and the hard bits and pieces that don't go anywhere else go. And the point is, you don't really need to collect the red top bin more than every couple of weeks. And that's what happens, I think, in Western Australia and currently in Victoria. But for some reason, the Liberal leader thinks this is a big issue. Do you reckon it's going to chime in Victoria?
I don't know. I think there's other issues that will train people's minds more. Now, I should say the Liberals are doing pretty well in Victoria. So they're polling pretty level with Labor, and One Nation's a little bit behind. So it's a different polling pattern. But there's a three-way vote at the moment in Victoria. The new leader has helped stem the bleeding, but is not really, the early polls not radically changed that, which I sort of expected because, they've got longer-term malaise and you can't just change your leader and change that. So I think she's got plenty of issues to campaign on anyway. I'm not convinced that will be the primary one.
Anyway, excusing the pun, it's added a little bit of colour and movement to the election, Martin. Do we have a secret sort of underground burning issue in Secret Harbour to match the red bin election in Victoria here in Western Australia?
So there's a few things going on there. There's lots of question marks over different candidates. So, you had, was the Labor candidate being gagged and, being unable to talk? Well, it would appear so, and it would appear that she's more recently found her voice and been able to communicate a vision a bit more. So they've obviously had an issue there and cauterised that. On the One Nation side, there's the question about his past and I think a few question marks over some recent comments about how much he likes fighting. Mind you, to be fair to the guy, he does run a fitness gym and that includes boxing and other things, part of that. People also question the Liberal candidate and sort of around relevance. Are they serious contenders or they're just trying to channel preferences to One Nation? So all of these things, I see Michael as the usual argy-bargy of a by-election. It's, of course, the only game in town in Western Australia at the moment. So it's not surprising it's probably getting a lot of airtime, but we are nearing its conclusion. So we might try to offer a bit of a crystal ball at the end of this month, a bit of a crystal ball around the result there.
Well, Mark, the candidates that you just mentioned are also young from where I stand and look, even from your perspective. Is that the trend in politics to hand all this over to Gen Y or Gen X or whoever they belong to?
Not necessarily. I mean, the history of candidates, even with by-elections, is not especially young. They tend to go often for people more experienced. So I see this as a bit of an unusual phenomenon. You've got three relatively youngish candidates being presented to the electorate. I think that's kind of refreshing, Michael, and I hope we see more of it.
Well, what I'm also keen to see more of is the Fremantle Dockers winning and winning decisively. Big match on tonight at Optus, 10 minutes past six, Friday night football around the country. And the Dockers are playing the Adelaide Crows, who'll be playing for their grand old man, the Texan, Tex Walker, who's nearing the end of his football career in the AFL. He's announced his retirement. So he's only got a few games to go. It's looking pretty good, though. But do you fancy the Dockers' chances tonight, Martin?
I'd have my money on them. I'm tipping them. I don't believe they've lost a single game all year at home. So that bodes pretty well. And Texas Walker or no Texas Walker, I'm not sure that Adelaide quite have the firepower. So Dockers for mine.
Well, Martin, on that positive note, and before we say anything which might contradict it, let me thank you for joining me again today on View from the Roundhouse, and see you next Friday.
A pleasure as always.